Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 27th, 2016. We've got more information on the Clinton Foundation, a nest of corruption, influence peddling, and we're learning about Bill Clinton Incorporated, how the foundation is used to enrich the former president. It is more leaked information from emails out of John Podesta's account, and it confirms what I have long suspected about the Clinton Foundation and how, while, you know, the Clinton Global Initiative and the foundation itself has raised tons of money, and much of that money has been used for good purposes, that does not rationalize the way Bill Clinton and his old buddy Doug Band, who was a very low-level White House guy, kind of the body man for Bill Clinton, a gopher. Doug Band was made the head of the Clinton Foundation. He was the guy who is credited with inventing the Clinton Global Initiative, a shakedown of massive proportions. And in a whiny memo that he sent to John Podesta after Chelsea Clinton took up residence at the Family Foundation, Douglas Band tried to tell the story about how unfair it is for Chelsea to attack him because, after all, he had created Bill Clinton Incorporated. And the details are in the Washington Post today. They show that Doug Band was the rainmaker, the guy who shook down wealthy individuals or corporations or countries and got them not only to put money into the Clinton Foundation, but also to pay Bill Clinton consulting fees and speaking fees that totaled into the millions of dollars. If the contracts all hold, Bill Clinton will get more than $60 million from deals that Doug Band has negotiated and that are paying out into the future, into the period of time when Hillary is expected to be president of the United States and Bill will be in the White House with unknown duties. So the memo became public yesterday. It lays out the aggressive strategy behind lining up the consulting contracts and paid speaking engagements for the former president that have added tens of millions of dollars to the family's fortune, including during the years when Hillary led the State Department. And that triangle, the foundation, the State Department, and Teneo. Teneo is a company that was formed by Doug Band and Hillary Clinton fundraiser Declan Kelly. Teneo has these big corporate clients like Coca-Cola and Dow Chemical. And as you'll see in a moment, they have showered millions not only on the foundation but on the former president personally. Band in the memo explained that Teneo Partners had raised over $8 million for the foundation and $3 million in paid speaking fees for Bill Clinton. He had secured contracts for the former president that will pay out $66 million over the subsequent 9 years if the deals stay in place. For example, Band wrote that Declan Kelly arranged for the former president to meet the chief executive of Coca-Cola back in 2009 at the Clintons' home in Washington. Coke had contributed $4 million to the foundation between 2004 and 2010. Band also described how Kelly helped expand a fruitful relationship with UBS Global Wealth Management, introducing Bill to a top executive at a 2009 charity dinner. After that, UBS upped its giving to the foundation, signed on as a Teneo client, and agreed to pay Bill Clinton for speeches, about $2 million in fees between 2011 and 2015. Band also arranged the stinky deal where Bill Clinton was named the honorary chancellor of a scam university. It's a little more substantial than Trump University, but not much. It's called Laureate International Universities, a chain of for-profit international colleges. $3.5 million a year Bill Clinton gets, just for allowing them to use his name, and I guess he's appeared in some promotional videos for them. And so then we have the Clinton Global Initiative, this annual shakedown held in New York during the week of the UN General Assembly. And Ban described in this memo how he combined his work for the Clinton Global Initiative and Teneo. He said, yeah, I had a hotel room upstairs where I met with Teneo clients, and he gave free memberships in the Global Initiative to target Teneo clients. Those are worth about $20,000 a year, which is chump change to these people. But he also named Bill Clinton as honorary chairman of Teneo, paid him $2 million, and Bill returned all but $100,000 of that later. Chelsea got upset because she heard that the hedge fund owned by the former New Jersey Governor John Corzine had been paying the firm Teneo $125,000 a month just before his corrupt MF Global went bankrupt. So this is pulling back the curtain on a sordid and obscene triangle of interest, a nest of corruption. And one of the serious issues that has not been explored by the corporate media or exploited by the Trump campaign is why the hell Huma Abedin, you know, she's the wife of Anthony Weiner, the guy who tweets his crotch, but she's also the real top advisor to Hillary Clinton. And while she was on the payroll of the State Department, she was also on the payroll of Teneo, she was also on the payroll of the Clinton Foundation. These are conflicts of interest that show the channels that are available for donors to request meetings with Hillary at the State Department, to get favors from funds and agencies controlled by the State Department. And now it's all out in the open. And I have so many friends who support the Clintons blindly. And they've explained away the foundation. Oh, it does wonderful work. The family's never taken a penny from the foundation. They don't have to, because Doug Band lines up pay dates, not play dates, pay dates for Bill and Hillary. And we know she grabbed that $12 million from from the King of Morocco in 2015. Now, she grabbed it for the foundation. I'm not accusing her of putting it in her own purse. But they are oblivious to the optics of their obvious conflicts of interest. And Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton owe so many favors to the people who've made them millionaires that we're going to see paybacks galore when, presumably, Hillary takes the White House in January. And Nomi Prinz, the Wall Street insider turned whistleblower, she's a very bright woman who I've talked with on many occasions. Her most recent book is called All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. And at Tom Dispatch today, she published a lengthy piece called Waking Up in Hillary Clinton's America. And she said the high probability of a Clinton win means the establishment remains intact and the bankers can continue to make money, bend or break the laws with impunity. And Nomi Prinz notes the revolving door. Jack Lew is the current Treasury Secretary. He was a special assistant to the president back in 1993, and he hit the revolving door several times, including jobs on Wall Street, Citigroup, and, Robert Rubin is one of his mentors. And so the Clintons have a coterie of people who have followed them for years, who've used the revolving door to enrich themselves, and when they're in government, they reflect the interests of the banks that they used to work for and hope to work for after government. And when they're on the other side, they use their influence to pull the levers of government on behalf of the corporations that enrich them. So I encourage you to read the Nomi Prinz piece. It's got a lot of important points in it. And she closes this way, let's recap Hillary's America, past, present, and future. It's a land lacking in meaningful structural reform of the financial system, a place where the big banks have been and will continue to be coddled by the government. No CEO will be jailed, no matter how large the fines his bank is saddled with or how widespread the crimes it committed. Instead, he is likely to be invited to the inaugural ball in January. Because its practices have not been adequately controlled or curtailed, the inherent risk that Wall Street poses for Main Street will only grow as bankers continue to use our money to make their bets. In Hillary's America, Wall Street will still own Main Street. There's an interesting recap of voter suppression tactics at The Intercept today, written by Alice Sperry, and I'm linking to it. I think it's worth a read. I want to point out, though, that it does not include any reference to the interstate cross-check list. And I credit Greg Pallas, the intrepid fedora and raincoat reporter, who has gotten a hold of the cross-check list that was cooked up by Chris Kobach, the right-wing, knuckle-dragging Secretary of State of Kansas, who gets his money funneled through different entities that originates from the Koch brothers. And I think that it's really important to know that there are a whole array of voter suppression tactics. The Supreme Court decision overturning the enforcement clause of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is a major way that these tactics are being enabled. But nobody I have seen besides Greg Pallas is writing about or exposing the interstate cross-check list. There's another great story at Who, What, Why, Russ Baker's website today, and I credit the byline of Maya Lowenstein reporting that John Husted, the Secretary of State in Ohio, has had his wrist slapped by a court, which has ordered him to reinstate hundreds of thousands of voters before Election Day. And he did it in part because Ohio is participating in the interstate cross-check list. But Russ Baker and Who, What, Why are not including that in an otherwise excellent report. More than 200,000 voters were removed from the Ohio voter registration list because they didn't vote in 2008 or 2012. The court deemed this purge to be illegal and said if those who were unlawfully removed from the voter rolls are not allowed to vote, then the Secretary of State is continuing to disenfranchise voters in violation of federal law. And the court ordered that purge voters must be allowed to cast provisional ballots. But Greg Pallas has explained that all too often, provisional ballots don't get counted. So we're watching closely in Ohio. This is one of many efforts to suppress the vote. And as of today, the polls on average show that Donald Trump is ahead by a slim margin in Ohio, 1.1%. But that puts it within range of what I call the margin of graft. Now, it's also the margin of error. The poll could be wrong, and Hillary could walk away with Ohio. But it could also swing Trump's way. And that puts it within the reach of these voter suppression and election manipulation tactics. And so I consider it to be a very fluid situation. And I know many Democrats, they're looking at the polls in California here where Hillary is up by 23 or 24 points. Now, that enables me to cast a protest vote, and I shall. I will not be voting for Hillary Clinton on November 8th. But across the country, in some of the battleground states, I think there is a false sense of victory on the part of many Democrats. Yesterday, there was the one and only debate among the candidates for Senate in the state of Maryland to replace the retiring Barbara Mikulski. And to their credit, the major party candidates, Democrat Chris Van Hollen and Republican Kathy Zuliga, at least when they were confronted with the Green Party candidate who walked up on the stage and said, "I'm ready to debate," both Van Hollen and Kathy Zuliga said they would welcome Dr. Margaret Flowers. Now, I know Flowers a little bit. I've interviewed her many times. She is an excellent progressive. I'd love to see her get elected to the Senate. And the organizers of the debate established an arbitrary 15% level in the polls for one to be invited. Margaret Flowers is polling in the 5 or 7% among voters in Maryland. And I'll just point out that I'm not unalterably opposed to setting standards for participation in a debate. Back in 1992, I was the lead organizer of two Senate debates here in California. We had two seats open at the same time. And because there were so many people running, we had to establish criteria and exclude some people from the debate. Most of those were crackpots and people who didn't have a chance. But we used a 5% threshold, not 15%. And I would argue that that is a fair way to establish some basis for participation. I'm linking to the YouTube video of Dr. Flowers, who I think went to the Medea Benjamin School of Public Disruption. She did a great job, went up there, was very composed, explained that she's a qualified candidate on the ballot across the state, and that voters are being denied a choice. And as the deputies escorted her out of the auditorium, she kept talking as the cameras kept rolling. And that's where I think she learned a thing or two from Medea. I hope you'll click on the link and check out the video. And I believe that Kevin Zeese had a hand in orchestrating that. Kudos to Kevin. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people like you who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Dick Attlee in Maine, Jeffrey Stewart just renewed his annual subscription, Cheryl Fleming, Jason Spitzer, they're longtime supporters of my podcast. How about you? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button on all devices. No matter what you use, you'll see menu. Click on that. You get some options. Click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. You get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. The $50 annual subscription earns you a bonus book. They're displayed on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. Here in California, I don't watch a lot of episodic TV. And when I do, I use my DVR so that I can zip through the commercials. And zipping through the commercials these days, there are so many deceptive political ads paid for by deep-pocketed special interests. And those deep-pocketed special interests have figured out that their best line of attack is to describe their opponents as deep-pocketed special interests. I reviewed that when I went through the 17 ballot measures, and that podcast is still available. It's free on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Now, we've learned that the pharmaceutical industry is spending over $100 million, the tab so far $109 million, to kill Proposition 61. And it's a novel effort to lower prescription drug prices for certain government agencies here in California that buy drugs for the prison system, for veterans, for Medi-Cal. You get the idea. It is not a broad-based law that would restrict drug prices for everyone in California. I wish we had that, but that's not what Prop 61 does. And it is pegged to the prices paid by the Veterans Administration. And with $109 million in deception, the industry is kind of, you know, chipping away at the arguments in favor of this, saying, well, you know, maybe it's going to raise the price of prescriptions for veterans. Now, this is the industry, all right? And it is threatening to screw everybody if we attempt to stop it from screwing a few people. Do you get that? They're saying, well, gosh, who knows? If you link it to the price that the Veterans Administration pays, won't the drug companies just charge the VA more so that they don't have to, honor the same price for the state of California? That is such a disingenuous argument. And it shows the lack of any morality on the part of these drug makers. Now, this is occurring at the same time that voters are expected to approve the legalization of cannabis. And Big Pharma is not opposing that. And the group that sponsored Prop 61, and they have about $15 million so far, is the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which runs pharmacies and treatment centers for people with HIV. I'm glad they put it on the ballot. I can't be sure that some of these criticisms that are coming from the pharmaceutical companies might not actually turn out to be true. But I think there'd be some hell of great lawsuits that would result if that is attempted. Now, speaking of AIDS and HIV, there is a new study that has been published in the journal Nature that traces the origins of HIV. And they tell us that it arrived in the United States 5 to 10 years earlier than previously reported. The first indication was in 1971 in New York, and it showed up in forensic studies here in San Francisco about 5 years later. And by the time doctors were reporting the first AIDS cases in 1981, the virus was already deeply embedded in cities all over the country. Now, this is in conflict with the story that has held for many years that originated with a courageous San Francisco Chronicle reporter, a man I knew, named Randy Schiltz. Randy wrote a book back in 87 called And the Band Played On. He died of AIDS in 1994. And in the book, he suggested, he didn't have enough proof, that a flight attendant whose name was Dugas and who was a very promiscuous gay man was the man who was identified as Patient Zero, and that he was believed to be the guy who transmitted the disease to many Americans. He flew back and forth from Africa to the United States, and the theory was that he was the origin of the infection. Now, in researching this, they discovered that he was actually labeled Patient O, as in the letter O, and that Randy Schiltz transposed that into a zero. And the O stood for outside the United States as a way of describing where the virus originated. So it's very interesting history, and I have to say I accept the science. But for many years, over 20 years, I have believed what Randy Schiltz wrote, and so I'll work on adjusting that. Over the past year, I can't remember exactly when it was, I think it was in the springtime, I interviewed a drone whistleblower named Sean Westmoreland. He spells Sean C-I-A-N. And he talked about the PTSD that he has experienced from participating in military drones and the airstrikes that are launched from them. Well, he is now a man of conscience, and he posted on Facebook that he is out at Standing Rock. And if you have any interest in learning how to join the protests at Standing Rock, Sean provided a link, and I have included it in the show file for this podcast. It's the OssetiSockowinCamp.org website. Now, we have a couple of developments at Standing Rock. One is that the cops, who have been using excessive force and militarized tactics on the First Amendment protesters, have surprised us and announced that they have investigated the private guards working for the goon squad there and determined that dog handlers were not properly licensed to do security work in the state of North Dakota. Well, I'm glad they investigated that. I have no illusions that this is going to cause them to send the G4S private security mercenary types away from the water protector protests. But it does show something that was suspected by the Native Americans and other protesters on the scene. Also, we've learned that Donald Trump has a stake in the Dakota Access Pipeline, because he has at least $500,000 invested in Energy Transfer Partners. They operate that pipeline and many others, and the guy who runs it, Kelsey Warren, who has been fingered by our friend Charlie Pierce and other musicians in Austin, Texas, well, Kelsey Warren has given $103,000 to Trump, some to his election campaign and some to a super PAC, and also given another $66,000 to the Republican National Committee. So Trump has an investment there and has gotten campaign cash from Kelsey Warren. There's an interesting piece at The Intercept today about a whistleblower who ran afoul of the CIA back in the mid-1990s. Patrick Eddington is his name. He and his wife Robin both worked at the CIA. And Patrick discovered was exposed to information that proved to him that American troops had, in fact, been exposed to chemical agents during and after the much celebrated Operation Desert Storm, the war that evicted Saddam Hussein and Iraq from Kuwait in 1991. So Eddington writes that at the CIA, he objected to efforts to cover this up, and he was immediately placed under investigation. Then, a little while later, the spring of 1995, his wife was pulled aside by a friend at the CIA and told that security agents were asking questions about the couple, talking to every single person with or for whom either of us had ever worked. And they didn't care about helping to find out why hundreds of thousands of American Desert Storm veterans were ill. All they cared about was whether Eddington would keep his mouth shut and not expose the secret documents. He was infuriated. He published a book. The CIA tried to vet the book and eliminate a lot of the inflammatory information. And then Eddington goes into a parallel narrative about what was going on at the NSA. And if you've heard my interview with Bill Binney from earlier this week, he was a top mathematics and technical officer at NSA. And Eddington does a good job of explaining the thin thread program that Binney had helped develop and invent, and how Michael Hayden came into the NSA and killed that. And this led to the whistleblowing by Bill Binney. He went through channels like he was supposed to, and the retaliation included the loss of his security clearance, which means he could never work in the field that he had spent his whole career in. So, here in San Francisco, Twitter has announced that it is laying off about 9% of its workforce. 350 people will hit the street. It certainly has had a big impact on the election this year. I still don't cotton to Twitter. I tweet out every podcast that we release, but that's about it. And I look at Twitter and I just say, huh? I know a lot of people just love it, and it's a deep part of their lives, but not so much for me. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. It's free, and you're free to share it with absolutely everyone. It's also distributed every day on YouTube, which makes it easier for many people to access. Check that out. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.